East Meets... Welcome to East Meets West, episode 261. I'm Tom Merritt.
And I'm Roger Chang. 261.
Oh, wait. 262.
262.
Last time was 261.
Yes, we are now on a palindrome number.
Whoa, you're right. We also have a brand new website.
Courtesy of Travelocity.
It kind of looks that way. I just downloaded a theme. You know, the Cifuentes brothers made an excellent theme for us back in the day. But with the WordPress updates, the WordPress updates broke some stuff in there. And rather than prevail on their good natures, because I know they're busy guys, I just went ahead and found a nice free WordPress theme to put up there that cycles through different pictures. So it looks like you're booking a flight on Expedia or perhaps selecting a photo for your Windows desktop. Actually, you know, I could get rid of the banner that you can just turn it off in the options. But I like the structure of the rest of the site. It's very simple, very easy.
It's kind of cool. I like it.
All right. And it gave us two comments. Citizen Plain said, since listening to the show, I've been thinking a bit about the connection between touch and memory, which I find fascinating. Little Google foo revealed some scholarship on the subject for Roger. And from what I could tell, there does appear to be a connection between our sense of touch and our memory. My own theory is the connection is stronger or weaker in the same manner that some people have better or worse eyesight, hearing, etc. The hypothesis is only based on what I've observed in my own life. A couple of my family members relate to all physical keepsakes in a very powerful way that I don't. However, I think we relate some types of objects to memory more than others. I often find myself loath to give up hardback books, perhaps because of my love of reading. My stepfather, a former radio DJ, would rather die than part with his expansive collection of 70s Motown and 80s pop albums. P.S. For Roger, did you enjoy Dragon Con? And if so, will you consider coming back?
I did enjoy. I love Dragon Con. My only issue, I mean, currently is for budgetary reasons. It was pretty expensive for me, partially because I did initially plan on going, and after Veronica and Tom talked me into it, I booked my plane tickets a little later than I normally would, so I kind of got skewered on that. But it was fun, and really, you know, my only it's not even really a complaint. My only obstacle really is financial, and pretty much financial. So if the gods of fortune are on my side, or if fortune is on my side, wow. You know, there's lots of fortunate gods up there. I will be coming back. But if not, you know, just understand I'm trying to make ends meet, unfortunately, of late. My bank account is a little emptier than normal than it was last time this year.
What do you think of his idea of touch versus and memory?
I think people, and you know, it's interesting. Each of those things he brought up, I can relate to. Certain things that I see, for example, when I watch an old, so you remember the Great Space Coaster, right. That children's program. Every time I watch it, I get a certain nostalgic, emotional kick in me that I don't get watching, Riptide or Magnum PI. It's just because I grew up getting ready for school, watching that show, you know, I would get dressed and that would be playing on the TV, you know, eating breakfast. I associate with that time frame in my life. And so I have that mental picture of that time. And when it comes to things like hearing certain songs, I relate to the same way. And certain things I smell, like certain foods or certain aromas, like it's a perfume or perhaps a potpourri of some sort, will elicit the same reaction.
It's very tightly tied to memory. Yeah. And there's been some work about the idea that perhaps the area of your brain that recognizes smells is near the area that triggers memory, and that's why it's so tightly bound.
Although I will say I have never had any of those feelings quite as strongly with touch. Like if I feel like, for me, touch doesn't elicit that same emotion, then say, like he was saying, keepsakes. If I look at it, it'll elicit the emotion. But if I wasn't looking and I felt it, I wouldn't be able to kind of.
So it's the garner. Visual. It's seeing, yes. Not touching. That
exactly. You know, I'll feel the edges of it and stuff like that. But what I'm really is just following with my hands what my eyes are already doing.
I think it's all pretty much the same, whether it's smell, yep, or touch or vision. That that active pathway is somehow triggering a memory pathway in your head. And maybe the way people store memories is different from person to person, or even the way the brain's mapped out can be different from person to person. And that's why for you, touch doesn't really trigger the memory, but maybe for others it does.
Totally true. I mean, the brain is a very mysterious object.
Billions and billions of neurons.
And synapses and stuff.
Cool. Well, thanks, Citizen.
Yeah, that was a great comment.
Chandler Bing, which I assume is his real name, writes, I am a digital hoarder. I have 40 plus terabytes.
Wow.
I feel some compulsion to archive everything. I have no issue with throwing away physical stuff because I like my space, but I can't buy enough hard drives. I've always thought it would be interesting to see a show about digital hoarders, but I thought I was in the minority on that one. It's not nearly as offensive to see a person with a bunch of hard drives in a big case. Regarding archiving newspapers or magazines, it's really easy to find that stuff in any good library. That raises the question as to whether you're archiving for the sentimentality, for monetary value, for ease of access, or because you're afraid it won't be available in the future. I generally feel the compulsion from desired ease of access and fear that it will not be available in the future at the same cost or ease.
You know, for me, it's both sentimentality and ease of access. I am kind of regretting that I tossed away all my Dynamite and Hot Dog magazines I collected back in grade school, because it's really difficult to find any of that online. I mean, you'll find people on eBay selling batches, but, you know, not all the stuff I had. Mm-hmm. And, all, you know, it's weird because, you know, when you look back at, like, you know, when I find one or two copies, you know, I'll thumb through and I'm looking at it, it's like, this stuff is really not that interesting. But it was, again, like, you know, it
triggers those positive positive
exactly
associations,
exactly
positive memories. Yeah.
And so it's, you know, I can see how people connect objects with a feeling of both a sentimentality but security, because it gives you a sense of place. That stack of books over there, that was my high school years. That stack of books over there, that's my college. It's essentially mapping out your progression through life. And for many people, especially people who move a lot, you know, they don't have a sense of place in the physical sense where, you know, that's where I grew up and that's where I went to school, because they were like, say, like someone in the, you know, who was raised in the military family and their family got ping-ponged around. You associate so much of your childhood and growing up with the objects that you surround yourself with. And so you tend to cart those from place to place. I did that for the longest time. I mean, it took a lot of work on my behalf to kind of push all that stuff. I, you know, had to toss old school books, or at least donate them, toss old records, stuff like that. Stuff I was keeping for no other reason than to have it.
Yeah, I think my I should say compulsion. I hesitate to say compulsion, but my impulse to save things has changed with the advent of the internet. I used to save magazines because I wanted access to that information. And I also, in some way, felt this sort of sense that, what if I'm the only person who saves this issue of this magazine? You know, it might be
important
to have it. It might be hard to come by in the future. Even when I was like, well, there's libraries and libraries have stuff. And it's like, well, maybe the libraries won't have this for some reason.
You know, I stopped believing that way about, I think it was 3 years into when I was going to SF State. That's when San Francisco's new main library came online. So they moved from their old building to the new building. And what I discovered when I was reading some of the op-eds in the local paper was that they had to toss away a lot of books and magazines because there was not enough space.
Yeah, I worked in a library where they were running out of space all the time. It was, you know, it was the third largest library in the United States, and so they were constantly evaluating, trying to find duplicate copies, but occasionally making decisions that this isn't worth preserving.
And you know, I have a feeling in about 10 or 20 years we're all going to be searching for Chandler Bing, because he's going to have some copy of some website or, you know, article or something online that he's saved that everyone else is looking for.
Well, what I was going to say is I stopped feeling that I needed to save magazines when the web came along. Because I realized, oh, well, scientificamerican.com can have all of this information stored, and that's it. Done. Over. And eBay gave me an incredible insight into how many people out there collect things and
keep yes.
them and buy them. And so my compulsion to save information in physical form definitely reduced. I reduced the number of books I kept. I reduced the number of CDs, magazines, definitely. I don't keep hardly any magazines. The only magazines I keep are ones that are of special interest, like a souvenir program from a sporting event, where it's about the object reminding me of something familiar, not about keeping the information.
I keep things that people send me as gifts. I very rarely, if ever, toss away something that people have given me.
It's the guilt factor, huh?
Yeah, I mean, something like, you know,
do
when
you
I get a
make sure to display them when they come to visit.
No, because they don't often visit.
Do you do that? Do you do that with clothes? If somebody buys you clothes, do you try to wear them when you go see that person?
No, but I do make
only family members. But
I do make a point to wear it just because. Oftentimes when someone buys me something, they understand what my tastes are, and I find it kind of cool because
I was thinking of more of the family members who buy you something that you're like, well, this really isn't
my extended family has stopped the gift thing like 15 years ago.
They didn't give you anything, huh?
Yeah. They give my mother a phone call, and my mother might rag on me or something.
I'll be honest, gift giving for me has become a random event. I like to just suddenly have an impulse to buy somebody something and get it for them because I know they'll like it. I totally do that. To buy things because of an occasion.
That doesn't bother me so much. Only if it's someone that I don't really like all that much, but I feel obliged to buy it because it's their birthday or. Yeah. You know, you know what I mean? It's like you feel obliged to do something for them, even though, you know, you couldn't really give a hoot as much.
It's not about that. It's not about the obligation. Because more often than not, for me anyway, people are saying no gifts. You know, yeah, we're having a birthday party, but no gifts. And so that usually kind of just lets you off the hook right there, right? You just be like, oh, all right, no gifts. You got it.
And it's kind of funny. I prefer, like, when I, you know, you've been to my birthday parties. Yeah. I prefer people just showing up. And it's funny because as a kid, the one thing is like, what'd you get me? And as you get older, it's like, I don't really need more stuff. But what I do want is the company. What I do want is to see these people I very rarely get to see because I'm so busy or they live in different parts of the country and it's very difficult to get together. I mean, to me, that's more important. And it's interesting because, you know, it's actually kind of ties back to DragonCon a little bit. What I do at conventions like DragonCon, Comic-Con, and Tom is very well aware of this, is I love to take pictures because for me, pictures are such an important and powerful way to kind of keep a reminder, keepsake of an event.
Take only pictures, leave only footprints.
Don't repeat canons. Oh, wait, that wasn't canon. Canon is a very similar...
It's actually usually a sign in the Park Service.
Oh, no, canon has a very similar... phrase that they use for their marketing.
Well, yeah, they're imitating the phrase of the Park Service.
Oh, yeah.
But I do like to buy things for people sometimes, or even not even buy things, find things where I'm just like, I run across it. It's usually serendipitous. I'm not particularly looking for it. And I just say, oh, hey, you know what? Roger would like this, you know, and I just get it and then give it to you. It doesn't happen all the time. Doesn't happen even often, but it feels more significant to say like, oh, I know Veronica would really like this.
Yeah.
You know, I'm going to get it for her. Then to be like, oh, it's Christmas, so I have to buy things for everyone on my list.
You know, in some cases, I love doing that a little bit. Like just, you know, like this person will totally appreciate it. I'm always kind of a little reluctant. Because I don't want to feel that other person. I don't want that other person to feel obliged.
There's that weirdness about it, right?
Yeah.
Where it's like, look, this is no strings attached, really, and people aren't.
But it feels like you know they're thinking, okay, so now I got to reciprocate. It's like, no, no.
Well, and I've done that with friends of mine who weren't. I knew that they were in jobs like internships or entry-level jobs where they didn't have a lot of money. And maybe, like, for instance, one time a friend of mine needed a new headset to do podcasting. So I was buying one for myself. I bought two. And then I gave them the headset and I said, and they're like, well, you don't have to buy me a headset. And I was like, oh, I accidentally ordered two. You know, I just kind of fudged the truth and to make them feel better. But it was also like, you know, I just wanted to do something nice.
Oh, we're getting old, Tom.
Getting old.
I just wanted to help out the younger peeps.
I want to feel like I'm important in your life.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and it is weird. You know, it is weird because we don't have a culture of gift giving that is outside of occasion. If it had been the person's birthday, they would have maybe made a show of saying, oh, no, you didn't have to give me anything. But they would have totally understood.
I think that gift giving thing, I think there is, but it's in a much more personal way where it needs, you know, it has to be someone you know very, very well.
Although that's self-selecting, right? I'm not going to have the impulse to get a gift for someone unless I know them well enough to say, oh, I think Patrick would really love this. You know what I mean? Like, you kind of have to have that relationship for that to work in the first place. Otherwise, it's really weird. You know, you're just like, hey, I thought you would like this bird that dips itself into water. Really? You did?
You don't know it very well, do you? You know, and I'm wondering, you know, if a lot of that stuff is just because the awkwardness of the, you know, assumed or presumed formality. Like, oh, here's a gift. You know, like, what I used to do, you know, for wrapping paper for, you know, birthday presents when I was a kid was use the funny pages, like the comics.
Oh, yeah. I did that one year when I lived in Austin. I was trying to be all hip.
I'm not gonna give money
to the man for their fake wrapping paper, man. I'm going to be all environmental.
I got like a cool toy for someone. And, you know, it's like, well, you know, I hate, you know, not to be too prejudiced against it, but like all the wrapping paper is kind of flowery and a little, you know, not too masculine or
well, it depends on where you're shopping.
But. Yes, true. It is true. But I was a kid. It's not like I could hop in a cab and take me to the mall.
Okay.
Also, I could have tried that. So I just, you know, I used 20 pages. It saved me money, too. That was the other reason. More money on the present instead of the present paper.
Yeah, I actually kind of still agree with that, although I think my family thought I was crazy or cheap. One of the two.
Amazon solved that for me.
Yeah, the gift wrap, the automatic gift wrap. Although you have to pay for it. It's still expensive.
Yeah, you know, whatever. I mean, I don't have to deal with it.
Yeah.
It's like $3.
Everybody gets some shade of blue wrapping paper. Have you ever bought somebody an anonymous gift? That's what another thing Amazon's good. I've done that a couple times where I knew somebody wanted something. So I go to Amazon and I buy it, but I use the gift option so they don't know it came from me.
I've been tempted, but I have never done it. And I think partially it's because because I'm the only person that would have gotten that person, you know, this person that gift. I mean, who else would it come from?
Yeah. So you might as well get it.
Yeah, I just might as well say, hey, you know, enjoy this. Don't break it. I don't have the receipt.
I think, it's funny. Gift giving is perfectly acceptable. It's not something anyone looks at as weird or odd. And yet, it is a silent part of the economy. It doesn't fit into the self-interest of the free market because you buy things for people and you're wrong and it's a waste of money. You know,
that's
you buy somebody the porcelain pig bank and they're like, I do not want this.
You know what? I don't think it's a silent part of the economy because why else would you have like Hallmark stores and stuff?
Well, when I say that, I mean, it is an inefficiency in the economy.
It's inefficiency. Right?
Like we pretend when we make these economic models that every actor is acting logically. But when you're gift buying, you're not acting logically most of the time.
Well, that's
you're
the thing.
You're buying something that someone else has determined that they don't have the funds to buy.
Well, you know, a lot of what people do in the economy isn't logical. I mean, you know, like I go gaga over sales, even if I don't need the product. It's like, oh,
sure.
My God.
Yeah, there's other examples of inefficiencies like that.
You know, I think when people use the word efficiency, I mean, it's like you're dealing with the human condition. You're going to have that. And if you factor it in, you can understand. I mean, because like you've said before in the previous show, you know, economics is just as much about human psychology as it is about, you know, dollars and cents.
And there's just so much that we don't acknowledge when we speak of economics, when we speak of free market economics. It's like, you know, the rational actors and the well, there's an opportunity cost. And obviously, you know, you can make all kinds of arguments that gift buying is just a, you know, a factor in the economy that works in the mechanisms of the economy. But what about the unofficial economy of giving free stuff to each other at work? So this was huge when I lived in Austin, and I knew a bunch of bartenders, and I worked at a bookstore. So when I would go to the bar, one out of every three drinks, they would comp me. Just be like, yeah, I'm just not going to ring it up. And then it was sort of an unwritten rule. There was no conversation about it. But when they came into the bookstore and they bought some books, I'd ring them up with the employee discount. Now, these were neither official policies of the places of business. But they were, you know, they were, again, they were working outside of the economy in a way.
Although, you know,
like a barter situation.
My parents, I don't know if they still do, but they used to do the same thing. And the logic behind it, whether or not it's efficient, is I open the debate. The logic is that you essentially start developing a lifelong customer because you have this kind of unwritten understanding, this kind of agreement,
right.
and what happens is that, you know, you're solidifying, and you know, if anyone who ever works in the restaurant business knows this very well, your best customers aren't the ones that come in and spend a lot of money at once. It's the customer that repeatedly comes in over a period of months, years, repeatedly. Your best customers are the repeat customers, and you know, you can have one or two high rollers that show up and never come back. It's great, you know, it does help the bottom line, but the biggest percentage of your earnings come from repeat business. And I think part of that understanding is like, hey, you know, he's a cool guy, I want him to come back and shop at my store, or I want to shop at his store. And you know, you kind of have this.
Yeah,
you know,
but with your parents, they own the restaurant, so that makes total sense, and that actually does work in the traditional mechanism of how the economy works. But what I'm talking about is almost black market, because you're talking about employees, not owners, in both senses. And so it's not in the bartender's interest that I come back and spend more money. They don't really care. They're probably not going to be working there for that much longer anyway, and they're going to go somewhere else. And I certainly am not like invested in making sure that they come back and get another employee discount on the books. I'm actually working against the profitability of the store that I work for.
But it's interesting because you're working in your best interest by developing.
Yes, that's what I mean. Exactly. It's like a black market part of the economy. It's a hidden part of the economy. It doesn't count in the gross national product.
The gross. Well, like what you were saying, you know, a lot of things that we do, especially when it relates to economics, is very irrational. So, you know, Robert J. Shiller, he wrote the book Irrational Exuberance, explaining why that, at least in the U.S., the housing bubble took the shape
it
did.
But that's tracked economy. I mean, and that's perfectly legitimate, but that is a little different than what I'm talking about.
Well, no, I understand, but it goes back to kind of the psychology of what underpins, you know, economics, in that people were buying with the understanding that the market had no the high end of the top end of the market had not been reached yet, and that it was still possible to buy a home and then at some later date, say like 3-4 years down the line, sell it at a significant markup, making a profit. And even though people saw all the warning signs, they were kind of, you know, in a sense, delusional. They were kidding themselves in order to kind of perpetuate. It's like, oh, you got to buy now. You don't buy now, you're never going to be able to buy a house.
Yeah, but you're absolutely right. But that's totally different from what I'm
Oh, yeah.
I'm talking about things that don't get tracked. They don't show up in the housing statistics. They don't show up in the studies because they exist on a level that isn't counted. I mean, usually when you talk about that sort of stuff, people think of the drug trade, right? That is an untracked part of the economy. It's untaxed, untracked. I think there's all kinds of things like that.
They actually,
we're not actually rewarding the part of the marketplace that's supposed to be rewarded because we're not working within the constraints of how the legitimate free market is supposed to work. And I don't know how much of an effect that has on the way things actually work.
They factor that in. I've seen, but you're right. They don't track it because you don't have sales receipts saying like Tom Merritt gave this guy a discount. Mm-hmm. But they do factor that in because oftentimes economists, especially in economies where governance might be a little loose, they do sample polling to kind of get to gauge a general percentage how much money is traded and all that stuff. And you know, it's
high
not
level, but they try to account for
and it's you know, you're right, it's not an exact science. It's not the same thing as being able to compare, you know, tax receipts at the end of a tax year, but you know, they try to account for it, you know, like just like they try to account for, you know, what people will spend on illicit goods, like, you know, drugs or counterfeit, like, you know, like whoever's affected by counterfeiting will always pull up a number. It's like, whether it's software or a Gucci bag or something, it's like, we're losing $12 million, you know, to counterfeiters. And you know, I've always wondered if they just kind of pull that number out of their ass, or if they just gauge the number of people that buy
these. It's sort of like, well, would those people have actually bought your Louis Vuitton bag at full price? No. They wouldn't have. So are you really losing that money? Or have you just created another marketplace? It's a slippery slope. I mean, the music industry is the worst example of that. They try to put a dollar value on every file downloaded illegally as a BitTorrent or from Usenet. And it's like, those people were never going to give you any of their money.
Video
games, not a lost sale.
Video games are coming up just as bad. I mean, there are a lot of publishers that are blaming stores like GameStop for selling.
They do the same thing. Video games do the same thing. Oh, look at all this piracy. We've lost millions of dollars. No, you haven't.
There's not even the.
They have lost a little bit of money. You may or may not. There may be some people who would have bought the game who downloaded it, but most of those people who downloaded it because it was easy and free. They didn't download it because they're like, oh, I was going to buy it, but now I can save $60.
Well, I'm not even talking about piracy. They're pointing fingers at the used game market where people.
Oh, that's just freaking ridiculous. That's like the publishing industry saying they're losing millions of dollars to libraries because you can go check out a book for free. That's just silly.
But I mean, it is, you know, it's one of those things you always see. It's like some publisher, you know, it is incredibly, you know, reaching for an argument, but at the same time.
Well, guess what? The used video game sales are going to go away. They will disappear because what's going to happen is people are going to buy digital copies.
Oh, yeah.
There's just no reason for physical media except for collectors.
Believe me, I know. And you know what kind of irks me is those digital copies cost just as much as the retail copy without the disc, without the box, without the package.
Because what you pay for the physical copy is not based on the cost of making it. It's based on what you'll pay to play the game. And that didn't change. The fact that you want to play the game didn't change. So if you'll pay $60 for the physical package, you'll pay $60 for the digital version.
That's true.
Although, people get really bent out of shape when the Kindle books cost more than the physical copy. They're like, but it doesn't cost nearly as much to do a digital copy. It's like, yeah, but that's not how you you don't sell something based like, okay, it cost me $5, so I'm not going to charge more than $7 because that's reasonable. No, you sell it for the most possible amount of money you can get. So if you can get more from people who are buying digital books because they like the convenience of it, then you should charge more.
Hmm.
Don't you think?
Yeah. No, I agree with that.
And I won't buy it if it's too expensive.
Although, you know, the argument can be made is instead of a digital copy, I can have a physical copy that I can then sell to my brother, my neighbor, blah, blah, blah.
Or it'll force me to go back and buy a physical copy instead.
And that's why I don't buy digital music. I only buy CDs.
Ah, I see.
And now I have a freaking wall of CDs that I don't listen to because I ripped them off.
I don't care that much about music to have to buy CDs. You know, I like to listen to it, but...
You know, it's kind of weird. I'm to the age where I'll probably buy into a music subscription service because I get like hundreds of CDs. I don't listen to them really that much anymore.
It's funny. But, you're going to make a total leap over the digital music saying, you know what? Forget it. I'm just not going to keep any of it.
Yeah.
Get rid of it all. I won't own any music at all.
You know what I'm going to keep? I'm going to keep my playlist. So in 50 years, I'll go to whatever new fancy schmancy, music service.
Yeah, see, that's what worries me though, is that your playlists end up not being exportable or readable or something like that.
Then you got to pay someone to do it. Lame.
Before we wrap up, I have one last question. This is an idea that's been kicking around in my head a lot. I just want to get your opinion on it. We have this, terribly stagnant economy, especially in the developed world.
Yes.
And, this summer has been a big storm and drawing about it. Do you think that it is possible for through technology, through localness, through nicheness, for people to create their own vibrant economy outside of this collapsing economy? So in other words, you just say, you know what? I'm just going to opt out. I'm going to sell stuff that I make online to other people who like it. And could that self-sustain sort of a bubble inside of the otherwise like horrible recession? Can you escape the effects of banks and the financial industry by producing locally? And local, not just geography, but also local to others of your interest group.
I would say it's one of those questions I'll answer yes and no. It depends on the scope of your economy. If you're going for things that aren't capital intensive, like food or handcrafts or labor, as opposed to something that you will need, you basically need a large corporate entity, whether it's providing medicines, telephony services, digital services like internet
I'm sort of assuming that stuff just keeps going out of inertia. So
it that stuff will still exist, but then you still have this weight of debt. I mean, the banks won't stop foreclosing on someone's home just because they will make.
I'm saying you will make money by producing and selling to the niche, and then those people can make money off you because you'll buy their stuff. And yeah, certain amount of money bleeds out of the system, obviously.
Well, you can do that. I don't think it will be as much as you were.
It's not a question for individuals. It's a question of whether these kind of mini societies can sustain themselves.
I mean, there are plenty of examples of similar systems, but they still require the larger whole to work. I mean,
saying that larger whole is destroyed or.
Oh, no, I understand that. It's
not
just
some utopian.
But, I mean, I think people's expectations will have to change. Things that they used to take for granted, they won't be taking for granted, especially if it's something that's going to.
I think you're interpreting it too drastically from what I mean. And I'm probably not doing a good job explaining
it. I think you're asking if you say, like, we just take a neighborhood, my neighborhood, and everyone in this neighborhood begins to just have an economy with each other where we're trading goods, services. Yeah. I think that could self-sustain, but I mean, it.
I don't think it would work in a neighborhood, to be honest. I think it'd have to be on the internet. And it's like, okay, so I make music that's really funky and a few people like. And I find just enough people who are willing to pay $10 a month to buy my stuff that I make. And then I start buying other stuff like that. And I also buy from the local farmers who are also into the same sort of thing. And they're on the internet with their internet fruit delivery, and they're buying my CDs. And so, it all just kind of swirls around like that.
I don't know. I don't think so. I think you could have a limited type of style economy based on that. But at some point, some of those consumers will still need to have a job that will probably be affected in some way or another by the larger economic malaise. So unless everyone decided to go like, you know, screw it, we're not going to use dollars, golds, or what, we'll have our own trading system, you know, barter bucks or something like that, where
I don't
we
think you need to have a new currency, do you?
Well, you know, if you're gonna have a parallel economy, you will need to find some way to fund it.
Why? Why not just use dollars?
Because it'll be scarce. You could say you have a set $100,000 to trade within, you know, a group of 1,000 online people. At some point, if you want to expand beyond that, you're going to have to get more dollars into it. Yeah. That means
that's what I said, some of the money bleeds out of the system, but there are also people who sample the system and inject some money in. So
I think it, the problem is I see it as a pyramid system where
so what you're saying is you have to do corporate concerts every once in a while so that you inject some of that corporate money.
Someone will have to do a corporate gig.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. Someone will have to have a job that's connected to the larger.
It doesn't have to be a job. It could be a contractor.
It could be. Well, it's a still
food,
it's
the local
work.
Food guy has to cater, some big corporate banquet.
Some paying work of some type. For me, it still feels like a pyramid because, you know, it's only a segment.
It's a circle, and, dude. It's not a pyramid. It's a circle of life.
No. All right. It's a rhombus.
Let us know what you think of anything we've talked about. Subbrilliant.com/EMW. Also, let us know what you think of the new simplistic design. That's it.
Travelocity.
Yes. That's it for this edition of East Meets West. Not brought to you by Travelocity. Although we're open to the idea. We'll see you next time.
Bye.
Network. For more information about this and other shows, visit frogpants.com. Audio program so good, it's like you're there.